Empower Radio presents The Farkas Files, an exploration of energy, metaphysics, and the paranormal with David Franklin Farkas. The Farkas Files. The truth is in here, somewhere. Here's your host, David Franklin Farkas.
Good evening. Thanks for being with us again. We're going to have some fun in our continuing series about the question of hell. And we're making lots of hell jokes lately, but because what else can you do when that's your topic? My guest tonight is the second author that I've interviewed on this topic of what is hell? Does it exist? Is it in scripture? Kind of continuing conversation that has been fascinating as I find more and more people who have done this research. Tonight, Julie Furwerder is going to talk about her book, Raising Hell, Christianity's Most Controversial Doctrine Put Under Fire. And we'll be talking to her in a few minutes, but first, tonight's metaphysical musing. And as often happens, there's a storm forming in the Caribbean. A relatively minor hurricane, I guess, as hurricanes go. And it's going to come up the East Coast, and everybody is freaking out. We've got stuff about the snowicane, because they think it's going to be cold enough for it to drop snow. And the snoreaster was another one, and snowpocalypse. And they're already talking about, you know, doing the usual, oh my God, it's coming, and it's going to be big, and it's going to have a high wind, you know. All the stuff that you always get, because what keeps people on a particular news channel or listening to a particular politician or whatever it is hype. And hype is mostly fear. Fear is a really interesting thing. Well, first of all, there's this phenomenon when a snowstorm is coming. I don't know if it happens everywhere in the country, but it happens here in New England. And as soon as someone says the word snow on the radio or television and gives a date, the day before, everybody shows up at the grocery store and they buy bread, milk, and eggs. Now, I don't know why everybody wants French toast when there's a snowstorm. And I think it's a law in Massachusetts that you have to do that because somehow everybody is compelled to do that. But there's something very primal and a need to feel like you've got what you need to survive in some basic way that happens when people hear that a big storm is coming and the power might go out and I might be stuck and there won't be lights and how am I going to – all of those questions. Now, a natural phenomenon like a storm is something that you can really kind of track with the weather – stations at this point and figure out sort of what's going to happen. And you know, it's going to last a day, maybe 2 days, and it'll be over. And you can handle that. But this whole concept of pumping up fear and the effect of fear on people is something that's fascinated me for a long time. And then I kind of watch and read about. Fear is, in almost all cases, a lie. You know, my standing line is, if there isn't a gun being pointed at you or a saber-toothed tiger, you can pretty much just look at the situation and handle it. It's not a fight or flight, oh my God, I'm going to die situation. But that's how most situations are presented to try and motivate people to do whatever it is the person wants you to do. So most of the time when someone says, be afraid, be very afraid, it's a manipulation. And most of the time that manipulation is either that they want you to do something that you wouldn't do otherwise, or they want you to not do something that you would do otherwise. And the something they want you to do is often something like giving them money or voting. There's a reason that people tell you to be afraid. There's always a reason that people tell you to be afraid. And so I've gotten to the point where, number one, I know that anytime that happens, the person is probably lying. And that the biggest lie that you can tell is the opposite of the truth. So I take whatever I'm being told and flip it upside down and say, well, if they're saying this, it must be the opposite of it. And if that was true, what's really going on? And then typically follow the money. You know, if that was going on, why would they want you to take the action that you're taking? And that's a really powerful position to take when everybody else is going, oh, my God, it's going to, you know, add in whatever the freak out is about. Is just realizing that most of the time when someone tells you to be afraid, they are lying to manipulate you. And since we're going to be talking about hell, from my perspective, in the dance or war between forces of light and forces of darkness, in this dimension of space-time, lies creating fear is one of the very powerful tools of darkness. It's the primary tool of dark forces to tell you a lie that will get you motivated by being fearful and also take your power away by making you fearful. The other kind of lie is a false promise. Figuring out what it is that you really, really want that you think you can never have, and then saying that they can give it to you, even though they're lying to you and they can't give it to you. And by the time you figure that out, you're sucked into the situation and you can't get out. My favorite demonstration of that in a movie is episode 3 of the Star Wars sequence of movies, where we find out how Darth Vader becomes Darth Vader. And he basically gets tricked. They lie to him. They know what he wants. They know what he's afraid of. They lie to him. And then he has no way out. And his life is very different. So that's my metaphysical musing for this approaching stormy weather. And let's have a hell of a good time talking to Julie Furwerder. How you doing tonight, Julie?
I'm doing great, but are you trying to tell me that you don't believe the world is going to end again this year?
You know, I'm old enough to have listened to the hype about the world ending so many times and watched people react to it in exactly the same ways so many times, and watched the experts tell us whatever the scary story is, including in the 1970s, there was a very powerful scientific story being told about the coming ice age with the same kind of data that they're talking about with global warming. Now, I'm not saying global warming isn't happening, but in the 1970s, they were saying this many species are going to die. This is what's going to decimate all these cities that are not going to be able to be habitable anymore. This is how far the ice is going to be. And we must do something about it. And they really couldn't get any traction with the idea for whatever reason. It's one of the few scary stories that didn't get traction. There have been so many of those, oh my God, we're all going to die. It's time to get firearms and food and go off into the mountains of Montana. I just kind of watch people go through their stuff and go, but what's really going on here? So, no, I don't think the world's going to come to an end again this year. I think it's going to change. I don't think it's going to end.
I really like what you said, though, about the just recognizing that anything that breeds fear, just looking for the lie in it, because that's really what I've been learning a lot, too, in the last few years. And it's so liberating.
It really is, because you can't respond to anything if you're freaked out and running around frantic to try and save everybody because you're in fight or flight. You know, the interesting thing about fight or flight is there's a third response, which is probably the one that happens the most in nature and for people. And it's freeze. It's fight, flight, or freeze. And in most situations when people are confronted with a life and death thing, if they haven't been trained to respond to it, they just completely freeze. They may come out of it, but they just get immobilized. And that's what a lot of the fear stuff is about, is immobilizing people and then giving them an option that makes them feel like they're going to be saved.
Well, and adding to that, too, not just the immobilizing, but just taking away from the character of God, you know, anything that creates that kind of fear is basically destroying our view of God and his character and what
right.
he's up to in history. So,
Right. You know, and we can continue the, you know, the light and dark dance and who is God, which I think is more to the point in many ways in your book. In Raising Hell and looking at the doctrine of hell in the Bible. There are two things I want to make sure that we do. One is get a summary of what you've learned in doing all this research, because you've done some incredible research. I haven't finished the book, but it's amazing. And the other thing is your path to being able to do this and what you learned in doing this. Because everybody that I bring on the show has their story of how spirit has carried them through the process that they've gone through.
Well, I guess I would just say, you know, for me it began with a question, and I wasn't even looking for this question, but one of my friends and I had begun studying Jewish perspectives, and we were just realizing that the Bible is a lot different than what we thought in the way that the lenses that we read it through. And, you know, I started realizing that over 2,000 years, getting away from the original intent and message of the Bible just led it allowed a lot of room for error and wrong perspectives. And then I was presented with the question by someone that, you know, they showed me some verses in the Bible that seemed to indicate that God intended to save all people, and the verses seem pretty clear. And I remember wondering, why didn't I see those before? I've read through the Bible many times, you know, I've been teaching out of it, and when I got to those verses, how did I skew the lens on them? And so basically for me, that just started down a path of asking, what if I'm wrong? And being willing to, like you said, step out of the fear, because there was a lot of fear in that. Actually, you know, part of my own story is that I had a sister about 10 years ago get into a cult with her husband and 5 kids. And that just, you know, made me realize my sister's a really smart person. She's got a college degree. Her husband, you know, same thing. And they're very smart people. So I just had this fear of, gosh, what if I'm getting off the right path even by asking these questions? And I think that's kind of what religion does to you also, is it makes you fear thinking for yourself. And, you know, ultimately, I guess a cult, you're just changing one set of not thinking for yourself for another. And, you know, I guess going down this path for us was more like being willing to ask some hard questions of our faith. And so does that answer your first question? I can't remember what it was exactly.
Well, yeah, it's a start. But, you know, you obviously are a Bible scholar and a Bible teacher. And I love people like you because I am so not a scriptural person at all. And for a lot of reasons. You know, it's the difference between being a shaman and being a priest. So, so you know, it's not my perspective. And while in many ways I am a follower of Yeshua, you know, the Hebrew name for the Aramaic name for Jesus, I'm not a Christian. I wasn't raised in that tradition. So the scriptural, I know some scripture, but it's not scripture that I've studied over time. I was raised in a Jewish household. So when I run into people like you that really know it and really do the research, I just sit back in awe of, you know, how much you can find and how you do it and what you come up with. So I'm very, very glad to listen to you and how this unfolded and what you learned.
Well, and I don't necessarily take credit for all that because, you know, I guess I am kind of I want to get to the bottom of it kind of person, but at the same time, I don't have any formal training, and that's been an obstacle for some people reading my book. You know, the first thing they say is, well, where did you go to seminary? And my point is, if I'd gone to seminary, I probably wouldn't have been asking these questions and thinking
right.
for myself. So,
right.
You know, these days, though, I just want to say that your average layperson sitting in church has available to them everything that I did to do my research for my book. And I just started, reading far and wide. I took about a year of just reading everything I could get my hands on. And I basically used a systematic approach of trying to see which things made the most sense out of the biggest picture. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah.
And well, so that's, because I mean, there's a lot of information out there, and obviously a lot of it's not going to, amount to much, but I feel like you can find a little bit of truth on every shelf of the pantry, and mm-hmm. it can all either contribute to or take away from the bigger picture. And I feel like once you get a grasp of that bigger picture, which for me came through the Jewish or Hebrew perspectives, mm-hmm. then I kind of knew where I was looking for the pieces of the puzzle, like what fit and what didn't. And so I feel like, too, the internet has just made all this possible, because there's so much information available to your average person now that wasn't available 20 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. There are concordances and all kinds of scriptural references online now that were not available even a few years ago. So, mm-hmm. so as you ask these questions, because what I was hearing as I was reading the book is there's one underlying question of, is the doctrine of hell as it's commonly understood actually there in Scripture at all? And so that was one of the big pieces that you were doing. But I also heard in there a question, and it's something that Jackson Baer, the other author that I've talked about, is the question is, who is God, and is the doctrine of hell consistent with who you understand God to be?
Well, those are two important questions, and I know Jackson touched on the good dad, bad dad idea. Certainly, I have a whole section in my book devoted to the father picture and how, the way I see it now, we're all kind of a microcosm of a father's love. And, he put us in families. We have children. We love our children. There's nothing our children could ever do if we're functional parents where we would ever reject them forever, let alone punish them forever. And, one of the things I learned through the Jewish perspectives is that the divine law given through Moses, of course, it was the written law, but it becomes this part of the law, just it didn't die. This is the part that Jesus upheld, and that is there were two aspects to it. One was to not over-punish an offender, whereas, in Western Christianity, we're always looking for a way to over-punish people for a crime.
Right.
But the Jewish law was to not over-punish, and the second part of that was to restore the offender to society. And if you didn't fulfill those two, you were acting unjustly to your neighbor. So, that's just a really important thing and an important picture of God's love, and also the message that Jesus brought to the Pharisees.
Absolutely. Actually, one of the misinterpreted verses in the Bible is an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, because that was a softening of essentially killing anybody who is convicted of anything. So if you were a thief... If you were a thief, you were executed. If you, whatever the crime was, if you were convicted, you were executed. And what that verse was saying was, no, make the punishment fit the crime. You can't just
Absolutely.
Be killing folks. And mm-hmm. it's read as just the opposite. It's read as a laundry list of things you can do to people instead of saying, no, make the punishment fit the crime.
Well, and since the beginning, God's been having to undo the way that man would insert his idea of justice.
Right.
And, man's always willing to kill, steal, kill, and destroy, whereas, with God's ideal, the whole point is restoration and just that restored love between a father and his child and between brothers and sisters.
Mm-hmm.
Where basically, he made from, it says in Acts, he made from one blood, all the men on the earth. And the point that he's trying to say there is we're a big family, and someday we're going to all be accountable to each other in ways that we haven't had to be here, I believe. So,
right.
In a future age restoration process.
Right. So
it's just coming back to the loving God and loving people. And that's really all that we have to do at this point. So go ahead.
Well, I'm just I don't want to get into the meat and potatoes of this until after the break, because I really want to talk about what you found about whether the doctrine of fire and brimstone and eternal punishment and a lake of fire and all those other images actually exist. So let's hold that for a second. But you've brought up a very interesting aspect to almost all of the spiritual conversations, which is what is our responsibility to each other and what is our relationship to God and to each other. And that idea that hell doesn't make sense is very, very powerful. That it's inconsistent at least the way you came up with the question, with your understanding of who God is and what God would be doing in the world, what God would do to his children.
Mm-hmm. Well, and one thing I like to point out too is throughout the Bible, you'll read the word righteous and righteousness, like, you know, God's righteousness, and mm-hmm. it talks about people being righteous, but if you do a little breakdown of that word in the Greek or the Hebrew, it's actually the word justice and being
yes.
a just person. And that's like a completely hidden doctrine, I think, or teaching. I don't like the word doctrine. Let's get rid of that word. It's a completely hidden teaching of the Bible is all about justice and the way we interact with each other. And I think that that word righteousness, you know, maybe initially the intent was good where they meant in a just sense, but I think it's come to mean a moral code of do's and don'ts. And people completely miss the point that the Bible is actually a code of how we treat each other, because when we're just to each other, then we are loving God.
Absolutely. Yeah, the golden rule exists in one form or another in almost every tradition on the planet. Mm-hmm. And I think there are some deeper meanings to it, because it's a spiritual principle that predates all of the traditions. But, you know, it's always there, you know. We're responsible for each other. And what you do to other people is what's going to come back to you. So be careful what you do. Life is a mirror. So let's make sure that people know how to find you and find the book. What are your websites?
Well, the book website is raisinghellbook.com. And you can go there to find out more information. Also, the book is on Amazon, and I do have a personal website. It's julieferwerda.com. And if you don't know how to spell it, as all you have to do is type in Raising Hell and Julie Ferwerda, and you'll find my website.
Right, right. Terrific. And we have the possibility of people calling in and asking us questions and joining the conversation. So let me give that phone number. That number is 248-809-3475. 248-809-3475. Give us a call, ask questions, join the conversation, give us your thoughts. This is a fascinating topic, and I'm sure there are folks that have, if not opinions to share, but certainly questions to ask, because Julie's done a lot of work on this. So, I want to ask you a quick question. when did you first get interested in scripture in terms of really wanting to find out what was going on, what was hiding in there? What brought you there? Maybe that's not a quick question.
None of these are really quick questions, but I can just say, you know, I remember finding an error in the Bible, and all my life I've believed in the inerrancy of the modern Bible. And, you know, with that, I can kind of end with something kind of quick here on the topic of the inerrancy of the modern Bible. And, you know, surely all scripture is inspired. I do believe that. But what is scripture exactly? And, you know, people just want to hold to this inerrancy thing. But if you look in any modern translation, you'll find a completely wide array of the number of occurrences of the word hell. If you look in King James, you'll find it about over 50 times. If you look in NLT, about 19 times. NIV and ASB, around 13 or 14. And interestingly, David, all literal versions have zero occurrences of the word hell.
Right.
And I feel like if people are really interested in what is the truth, they should be paying attention to the number of occurrences in the modern translation, because really the modern translations are basically like a commentary.
Right. And that's, well, we'll get into rabbinical tradition when we come back.
Okay.
This is, you know, I'm totally fascinated with this. I have so many questions, but we will start down the path of what you learned when we come back in a few minutes. Again, the phone number is 248-809-3474. And we will be back shortly, unless we get taller, here on the Farkas Files on Empower Radio. Stay with us.
This week's episode, Danger at the Old Well.
Last one to the old well's a rotten egg.
Ha-ha, I win.
Whoa! Ah! Sassy! Johnny fell down the well.
I'm wet.
What, Sassy? You know where Mr. Gunderson keeps his rope? Go get it, girl. What? You'd rather use this time to set people straight about shelter pet adoption?
I'm cold.
People shouldn't be afraid to adopt from a shelter? Because shelter pets are screened for sound, health, and temperament?
I'm wet and cold!
Sassy, what about Johnny? What? Let Johnny sit in the well until he learns to be more self-reliant? Sassy!
What'd he say?
Sassy is brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org. Remember, adopt!
Come to the forest. It's a place not so far away. A place where you don't have to mow the lawn or babysit.
I saw lizards and squirrels and bugs.
Ladybugs, caterpillars. It's really cool, actually.
A place where you don't have to make time for free time.
Lots and lots of kinds of species here.
Out here, you may even meet the mysterious creature known as the other you, the enchanted you.
It's magic what flowers do.
The adventurous you.
My favorite tree, yes, it's that one.
The free-to-be-me you. Ask your parents to take you to this not-so-far-away place. Come to the forest, where the other you lives. But first, stop by discovertheforest.org, a public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
License and registration.
But I'm walking.
Do you want to upset an officer of the law?
No, sir.
Good. I pulled you over today for littering.
I didn't litter.
Wow. That's what they all say. Unfortunately, I saw you drop a pair of thunder thighs a few blocks back. Probably happened as you were biting into that apple you're holding.
How'd you know they're my thunder thighs?
Well, my young friend, I'd like to say 2 years in the police academy helped figure it out, but between us, it was smallstep.gov.
Smallstep.gov?
Yep, Rooney. It's this site with tons of easy ways to lose weight. Some steps are so easy, people don't realize they're doing them. Like you taking small step number 83, snack on fruits. Go to smallstep.gov, you'll see. You can drive off now.
I'm still walking.
Take a small step to get healthy at smallstep.gov. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Now back to the Farkas Files with David Franklin Farkas on Empower Radio.
And we're back with Julie Furwerder talking about her book, Raising Hell. And the direction we were going, and I wanted to make sure we did it after the break so that we had plenty of time to do it, is this whole research that you did looking for hell in the Bible. And not finding it, which I find fascinating. And some of the things that you mentioned, like Gehenna and some of the other translation issues, I had heard of before. But tell us more about what you did and what you found.
Well, like I said, I mean, there's so many things that contributed. But I guess, you know, for me too, another piece of this puzzle was that I had been kind of beating my head against a wall for several years trying to understand how to reconcile Calvinism and Arminianism. And just in case there's any listeners that aren't familiar with what those are, Calvinism is the, okay, well, first of all, both of those views together make up almost all of evangelical Christianity, but there are two opposing views on who Jesus died for and whose will prevails in the end, either man's or God's. And I'll explain that in a second. But Calvinism is basically the belief that there's just a few people who are chosen for salvation and the rest are damned forever. And in other words, God just made them a contrast to the ones that he chose. And so he created all these, you know, multiple billions of people just to send to hell forever. And basically what, you know, bothered me about that view is that I felt like God was too mean to save all of his people, even though he created all of them. And then Arminianism is the belief that it's your free will. You know, you are have to be presented, I guess, with the gospel, and you get to make a decision on whether or not you're going to choose to follow God. And supposedly by a lot of these people, they believe that every person who's ever lived has somehow been presented with a choice and that they choose hell, which, you know, once you really start thinking about that, it's ridiculous to think who would choose hell. And so basically they're saying that God is too weak to save all of his creatures because their man's will overcomes God's will to save people because he says it's his will that all be saved. So, you know, you look at those two, and what's an interesting thing to me about that is that you can defend both views scripturally, but you can't only defend one view scripturally because it appears like there's just evidence to support either view.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to ignore a lot of other evidence. You know, like if I'm a Calvinist, I have to ignore a lot of things that seem to say I have a choice. And if I'm an Arminianist, I have to ignore a lot of things that seem to say we're chosen. So for the longest time, I was just so frustrated. And I was like, there's got to be an answer that resolves both of these views. And so anyway, again, I think, you know, this is one of the problems of 2,000 years of getting away from the intent of scriptures. And once you land on a truer picture of God's plan for the ages, which takes you back to Jewish understanding, of course, you realize that both of these views are obsolete, and you find something that reconciles all the unanswered questions, which is really what I was looking for. So, you know, I don't know if you want me to elaborate on that at all right now, but...
Well, I want you to elaborate on that, but before I read the book, I hadn't heard the term Arminianism, if I pronounce that correctly, and I'm curious where that comes from.
I am trying to remember myself. I think there was a man back in the early centuries. I don't know. I can't remember exactly, but I think it was named after a person.
Yeah, they usually are.
Yeah. So anyway, I guess, you know, you put on the Hebrew perspective of scriptures and you realize that God has chosen some ahead of others to help him win all. And then you find out that there is a free will about it, although I don't like the word free will because if you take that to its natural conclusion, the world would just be complete chaos. And so, you know, going back to Jewish again, you find out that actually what God has given each of us is dominion. And for some of us, he's given us a little bit of dominion, and that would be like the influence or power I have over my environment, and some have a lot more. And so there is this unique and, you know, fascinating dance between the power that we have and where it, you know, intersects with God's power over his creation, which is ultimate. But anyway, so going back to, you know, just getting rid of the Calvinism, Arminianism questions, you realize that God has chosen some ahead of the rest, and that fits the chosen verses, but then he's asking us for relationship through invitation, and that's where our free will or our dominion come into play.
And so you found ways to resolve that.
Yeah, but neither one of them had to do with hell, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, it goes back to the father relationship. And, you know, you can just think of with your own kids, you can't force your kids to love you. And so, you know, it's always about the invitation with God, I believe. And I think this lifetime is not the only chance we have. We have future ages where I believe love really does win. And all people are invited into that relationship and distortions are removed. And, you know, I believe given enough time, everyone would respond to love.
And, well, that's absolutely what I believe as well. And it's always fun when what I believe is supported by Scripture. Well, one of the fascinating pieces of the book is looking at the various words that are translated as hell, how those translations are kind of inconsistent and either political or capricious, and what the words that were being translated as hell meant, and what the understanding became in the Scripture. It's kind of a lot to do, mm-hmm. 10 minutes or so, but so, you know, we could start with Gehenna if that's a good spot to start, because that's something that I actually had heard about and did a little research on.
Sure.
I know that Jesus was talking. Gehenna is a real place with a real history and real fire.
Yeah, correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Gehenna is actually the Greek counterpart of the Valley of Ben-Hinnom of the Old Testament. And, you know, I think you and Jackson kind of talked about this a little bit too, where it's a valley where the Israelites, according to scriptures, used to burn their, sacrifice their children. And, you know, they did a lot of other things too, but to their god Moloch. And oftentimes God used this valley as a place of national judgment for Israel. And it was a literal valley outside of Jerusalem, you know, and even if you go to Strong's Concordance, it even says that, and it just drives me crazy. You go to Strong's and it says a literal valley outside of Jerusalem where they used to throw the trash and the beggars and the thieves lived and, you know, this and that. And then they say also the future destination for all sinners as a place of fiery torment. Right. And I'm like, huh? How do you get that? How did you leap from this literal valley to the future place of torment?
Right. Well, my understanding is Jesus was using it as an example of both a place where there was a perpetual fire because they were burning the trash and dead animals and people who had been buried without a religious ceremony, people that were arrested by the Romans and executed. And he was saying, don't put yourself in the position where the Romans will do that to you. You don't ever want to be in a position where you wind up in Gehenna. You want to follow the teachings and the practices so that you don't run across the Roman authorities and get yourself into that kind of trouble. Render unto Caesar what is Caesar.
Right. And I would like to add to that, too, you know, from a Jewish perspective, and I hate to keep bringing that up, but I think it's so important, the Bible unfolds in layers and repeated scenarios. So in other words, if you have one prophecy or one story in there that is going to be fulfilled, it's not just once. It's going to be many times and on different mm-hmm. layers. And I will say, you know, there is this thought that the AD 70 Roman occupation was one of the layers of fulfillment of Jesus talking about Gehenna for Israel, and I think that's very possible. You know, for those who don't know, a million Jews were burned, or not burned, there was a siege against the city, and a million Jews were killed, and their bodies were supposedly thrown into Gehenna and burned, because what else are you going to do with that many bodies?
Right.
And so a lot of people think, you know, that Jesus was prophesying of that, and I think that's very possible. But I will say that I also take a metaphorical view of Scripture, and I do think that Jesus had a metaphorical meaning there. But, you know, as we can talk about more, when he talks about fires and Gehenna, well, you know, Gehenna also represented just being away from the face of God or from his presence in that outer darkness. And the fire, as we will learn from a metaphorical standpoint, fire was always about purifying and refining, not about punishing throughout the Bible.
Right.
And so even if he I was just going to say in closing, even if he did speak of a metaphorical idea of you know, a place of refining, I don't want to call it punishment, but, you know, purification and restoration, just like, you know, according to the law.
Right. The other thing about the Jewish tradition is that there are the original scriptures, but there's also 5,000 years of commentary of one teacher giving their interpretation, and then the next generation giving their interpretation, and on and on and on. And the Talmud and the Mishnah are this very, very complicated, you know, if you think how many angels are on the head of a pin is an argument, you really haven't read the Talmud. Very, very, you know, and it goes on literally for thousands of years. So,
oh, I agree. And I mean, even with the Jews, there were some who did believe in a type of hell. That was actually the Pharisees, but the Sadducees did not believe in a place of punishment. And in the Pharisee tradition, the hell that they taught about only lasted up to 11 months, and it wasn't anything eternal.
Right, right. Well, this whole idea of eternal also was kind of a translation error, wasn't it?
It was. It was a Jerome error. So Jerome, back in the 5th century, you know, he was translating scriptures, and it was either the late 4th or early 5th. He translated the Latin Vulgate, and, you know, they say that he didn't know his Greek very well, and he didn't like Greek, but I don't know if it could have, you know, it just seems to me that Jerome had a little bit of agenda in there, because he was really big about the whole punishment for sin and everything, but he changed a word that meant pertaining to ages into eternal. So he went from Ionian to eternum, which is a Latin word for forever, I guess. But even the concept of forever back in the times of the Bible, I don't even know that it had been thought up yet. That was more of like a Greek idea or something. So,
well, there's also in Aramaic and some of the other Middle Eastern languages, there's a tense that is all times at the same time. So it's past, present, and future being talked about simultaneously. And that doesn't exist in Greek. So they had to do something with it, and they chose to put it in the future. And that completely changes the understanding of some of the stuff that was being talked about, which was basically saying it's always like this. It was in the past, it is now, it will be in the future, this is how it is. Not that it will be somewhere else. So the kingdom was never intended to be in the future. Kingdom always existed.
Well, what's interesting too is even now, if you read the New Testament in the Greek interlinear, most of the passages that people try to quote, you know, for the hell proponents and the futuristic flair, like say, take John 3:16 or any of those verses about Ionian life, they all have a present progressive verb tense that was not carried into English, where it's speaking about life pertaining now, you know, like Ionian life begins now, and it speaks of it in a present tense, not a future tense.
Right, right. So explain the term Ionian, though.
Well, Ionian is it's a word, a Greek word that means pertaining to the ages. And, you know, from a Jewish standpoint, which maybe I should be having you elaborate on all the Jewish stuff, but
I'm no Jewish scholar.
The Jews believed that there was a plan of ages that would be actually follow with their idea of their feasts and their jubilee and all those things. Well, all those things, it, you know, back in the Old Testament, the Hebrews had all those feasts and harvests and all those things. They weren't just about farming and about eating or, you know, partying or whatever. They were actually practicing, they called it dress rehearsals for a future event. And, you know, where you were just saying it wasn't so much about future, but they still did believe that in a unfolding plan that God was going to be making those things that they were practicing into real events. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. And
like, for instance, let me just give you a concrete example here. Jubilee, which happened every 50th year. Some Jews think every 49th year, but regardless, it was a time where debts were canceled, slaves went free, people were restored to the properties and things that they had to sell in their slavery. And what the Jews believed is that that signified a future time or age where people, that would be true for people in every way, that people's debts would all be canceled, everyone would be free. It would just be kind of the culmination of God's plan for the ages.
Right. Right. And won't that be a wonderful time? You know, you started out by saying, you mean you don't think that the world's coming to an end this year? And all of those predictions say not that the world will come to an end, but the end of the world as we know it. And, you know, we were talking about the light versus dark and when the light wins. And that's my understanding of all those predictions, is a time when the darkness is gone and no longer rules the world.
Yeah, you know, I don't know when that's going to be, but surely things are changing fast. They say our information is doubling like every 4 months now, and we can clearly see that things that we never thought were possible are becoming more and more possible. So I'm with you. You know, I think there's a beginning ahead, not an end.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, there are people that think there is an end, and the power of belief is very strong, and perhaps for those people, there will be some kind of end in their experience, because we're creating all of it. That's another conversation with, I guess, Christina from last week about the quantum physics of prayer, healing, and all of the spiritual practices, is we're affecting space and time. And, you know, science now has ways of talking about it, but the mystical traditions have always had ways of talking about it. So when I started with the metaphysical musing about fear, that's a big piece of that. You know, when you no longer are afraid of what other people are telling you to be afraid of, you have more control over what you create, because you're not creating from someone else's beliefs and you're not creating from fear. And I think that's... Go ahead.
Sorry. I was just going to say, on my blog, I addressed this. I've addressed the apocalypse and what a lie it is. You can't find any evidence for an apocalypse when you start looking around in the Greek and Revelation, not to mention Revelation is a symbolic book. But have you ever seen the movie I Am?
I don't think so.
It's put out by, I forgot his name, it's the guy who made all of the Jim Carrey movies. Anyway, he made this movie, and it is just really awesome about how connected electromagnetically we all are to the earth, and how, you know, people collectively can influence weather and all kinds of things. But they're scientifically proving all this now, which is just mind-boggling.
Yeah, which I sort of, not very systematically, but I have people that tell me about the kinds of stuff that's going on. And there are a lot of experiments using prayer or meditation or any number of other things, either with a group in one place focusing together or with people all over the world focusing on a particular issue in a particular location. And they've got the statistics on how much they can affect the amount of violence in the Middle East, for example. You know, while the experiment was going on and the focus was happening, the incidence of violence would go down. And they did it with some American cities. They did it with the Middle East. You know, does this stuff get distributed widely so that people will get the idea? No, it's, you know, in the background for people that think that way and want to know about that stuff. But, you know, is the evidence there? Yeah, there's a lot of evidence for that. And that's... doing it as a group with the same focus is a magnification of what we're all doing every day, all the time, in creating our lives and our experience. So you get what you focus on. And the golden rule saying, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, is basically saying, do it that way because that's what you're going to get. The world is a mirror. The universe is a mirror, and what you're putting out into the world is what's going to come back to you. So there are people that are living terrible lives and are doing terrible things, And there are people who are having wonderful lives and doing wonderful things, and they live in the same world. Mm-hmm. They could be living side by side, but their experiences are totally different. And focused attention and deciding what you want, which is basically what prayer is, is focusing your attention in a particular way and asking in a particular way, literally creates reality.
That's interesting, because I did a big study on what prayer is, and I think the Greek word, you break it down, it's like well-thinking or well-something, but to me it was the idea of thinking well toward and being lining yourself up with what is good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what is God? Yeah. You know, I mean, for me, it'd be like lining myself up with the will of God, but it's that well-thinking and aligning yourself with what is good. So that was really interesting.
Yeah, and that's in many monastic traditions, that's the focus of what they do, is aligning yourself with the will of God and finding what that is for you. You know, getting quiet enough and doing enough exercises, chanting, whatever it is in that tradition, that you begin to approach the vibration of whoever you're calling God. And, you know, to me, being the heretic that I am, there's only one of whatever God is, he, she, it. And everybody on the planet who is saying that there's a God has to be talking about the same thing. Mm-hmm. So arguing about who God is to me makes absolutely no sense. There can only be one. Whatever the creator is, that's what the creator is. This is a conversation I can tell we could probably do this for 3 hours, but we're running out of time.
go ahead. Are we finished, or do we have time
go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, going back to the health thing, one thing that I would like to say before we end our conversation is, you know, hell is only according, you know, if you're going to go by the literal Bible, it's really only mentioned on like 4 occasions in the Bible, and that's all in the New Testament by 3 different writers, Matthew, Mark, and Luke.
Yeah.
And I was just going to say, you know, even Paul was the apostle to the Gentiles, and the Gentiles didn't have an education in things of the Spirit, and so Paul was like their only teacher to teach them what they needed to know. And Paul never once uses the word hell, and there's actually only one place where Paul even sounds like he might be talking about, you know, the traditional view of hell based on the way it's translated. He says something about being taken away from the face of the Lord for everlasting destruction, although that word is age-lasting destruction, and that's in 2 Thessalonians 1:9. And so, you know, what I just wanted to say is, if hell is really the worst possible outcome for any of us, and Paul was our best bet, and he only said one thing about, you know, possibly everlasting destruction, which isn't even what he said, how completely irresponsible would that be? And, you know, I just want to point out, too, an interesting thing. The word he used for destruction there is Strong's 3639, and it's this is the definition. It's alethros is the word. For the destruction of the flesh, said of the external ills and troubles by which the lusts of the flesh are subdued and destroyed. So that isn't even talking about the person. It's talking about like how we go through a refining process.
Right.
And interestingly, you know, that word is used in many places where renewal is being shown, like the place where it says to cast a person out of fellowship that their flesh may be destroyed, so his spirit is saved on the day of Christ, you know?
Yep.
That's the same destroyed. And there's a place where it talks about the destruction of the world, but it precedes renewal. So if you actually do a little study on that word, it shows that it is a word that means preparation for renewal and not utter destruction. So you just, you know, the thing we can all come away from this is we have to take a much more thoughtful approach to scriptures and not just trust what we're reading.
Right.
And, you know, if anything looks suspect about the character of God, it probably is, and you should probably do a little bit of study.
Absolutely. Julie, thank you so much. We are running out of time.
Thank you.
Julie Furwerder's book is Raising Hell. You can find the information at www.raisinghellbook.com. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you, David. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. And if you're interested in my work, you can go to househealing.com. And you can find every conceivable way to get in touch with me, lots of information, and a way to schedule a no obligation complimentary 20-minute scan and assessment to see whether my work will do what you need at the moment. So we would love to hear from you. Next week, we have yet another author who is writing about the very same subject. Does hell exist in Scripture? And Anthony Wayne will be with us talking about what he found out in researching his book. So we will have a hell of a good time with Anthony as well. So getting back to our metaphysical musing, as I love to do at the end of the show, one of the things that you really need to focus on as things get strange is what do you feel is right and what's going on for you, not what somebody is telling you to be afraid of. So for the Farkas Files, the truth is in here somewhere. This is David Franklin Farkas on Empower Radio. Stay with us next week, and we will continue this adventure. And I'm David Franklin Farkas, and I approve this message.